Hello and welcome to End Credits here on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus and Community Radio. And I am your host, Adam A. Donaldson, and joining me today is...
Peter Salmon. I'm a student here at the University of Guelph and just love film.
And Tim Phillips, I'm a local filmmaker who also loves film.
Well, we're glad you're here. This would be a pretty boring show without people who love film. And this is Tim and Peter's first time on the show, and if this is your first time listening to the show, End Credits is a local movie show for local movie fans. You can listen to us here every Wednesday at 8 a.m. to talk the latest in pop culture and review the newest movies, which this week will be the Canadian biodrama Maudie. That's in the back half of the show, though. For the first half, we are going to talk about some of the things that have been making news this week, including whether or not you can separate the artists from their private life and their private works. Bill Cosby, Roman Polanski, Johnny Depp are all recent examples. But are there any long-term effects on an actor or director's legacy when they are ending up in court? And when we'll talk about Batman and Robin, which was released 20 years ago this month, and is perhaps why Joel Schumacher is now apologizing for the affair and explained the deal with the nipples on supersuits. But first, a controversy over clean versions of movies. Sony is planning on releasing versions of their movies that take out all the excessive violence, sex, and swearing in the same package as the unedited version, but filmmakers are still upset. They're crying censorship. But is it... So Tim, let's start with you. You are a filmmaker, so how would you feel if... somebody releasing your film came to you and said, you know what, we want to make this marketable to others, and so we are going to take out all the stuff that you put in the film
as
a creator, and we're going to release a clean version. How would you react?
Well, I would be really upset by that. Obviously, that's like taking control of something that you want to have control of as a director. You want to have the final cut. It's your vision. So in this whole affair, it struck me that they didn't give the directors the notice they required. It seemed it was a real surprise tactic. Okay, we're going to put out these clean versions on the DVD without any approval by the directors. So I'd be quite miffed about that if I was a director. One thing, though, I think they could look at is there's an opportunity for marketing with the clean version, for instance, because I was watching some clips where the dialogue was replaced with fake dialogue, right?
Yeah.
And it was quite funny. Like, there's an example with the Big Lebowski where it's find a stranger in the Alps or feed a stoner scrambled eggs.
Yeah.
This is what happens when you feed a stoner scrambled eggs, right?
And Samuel Jackson was great doing it. It's in Snakes on a Plane as well. Just changing it to Mother Truckin' instead of the other word.
Yeah. Or a Monday to Friday plane. Yeah. That's the flip side of it is I do think it was like a total marketing thing. Mm-hmm. Because you get the one movie, the one version of the film, the unedited, and then you get the clean version. It's like a get a 2-for-1 deal. But Peter, what were you thinking as just a movie fan?
I'm not sure. I love Sony. I'm a Sony guy. All my TVs, all my products. But blocking that, I'm not okay with it with regards to certain films. Judd Apatow tweeted about it, and his tweet just had multiple swears. He was not happy about it. And I think that's fair for films like that because it's all about the swearing and the nudity and things like that. And censoring all that would just – the film wouldn't be the film.
Mm-hmm.
But I think like Snakes on a Plane, films like that where kids could watch them without the swearing, I'm okay with them doing it for that. But I'm not a director, so.
Right.
The weird part of it is that like it's movies I was looking over the list and some of them are movies that are already PG or PG-13, so like the Spider-Man movies. So I'm not sure parents would have a problem people watching the Spider-Man movies as is.
Right, yeah, I watched them as a kid.
Yeah, or the Ghostbusters movies, the first two Ghostbusters, the original Ghostbusters, or something like Pixels, or Goosebumps, which were also PG-13 movies. I guess there's some rude humor in Pixels.
Yeah,
I haven't watched it all the way through.
Yeah.
But, I mean, still, these are movies that are kind of directed at a family audience anyway.
Right, so it's kind of like overkill to do a clean version on something that's already already so clean, right?
It would make the kids just not enjoy it whatsoever.
Yeah.
But you're right about the I think there's almost an art form to the, you know, the quote-unquote clean version, the TV, especially the TV version. This is where this debate always kind of grabs me, because when it's, whenever it's like comes on a company level, there was a documentary about 7 years ago called, I think it was called Clean Flicks, and it was about the company Clean Flicks that takes movies and sort of sanitizes them for Christian audiences.
Okay.
And I guess because that was a company sort of taking out their intellectual properties, one thing, and the same thing with Sony here, but when you're just going back on like Airplane versions of movies, mm-hmm. although I from what I gather, a lot of airlines don't do the censored versions anymore. They just put the straight up the whole thing on. Mm-hmm. Or TV, you know, how many times have you watched Die Hard TV and heard mm-hmm. like Yippee-ki-yay, Mr. Falcon, or
yeah, or
Find
Mr.
a Stranger
Falcon?
In the Alps. Yes, it's or you know, Ferris Bueller when he calls Cameron's car a piece of tin, which is why they take it's Cameron's father's car. Yeah. It there's almost something, I don't know, there's almost something priceless about it, like something, because, right. You know, there was almost an art to it. You know, the whole Find a Stranger in the Alps thing. What does that even mean?
Yeah, it's so random, right? And it's Comedy Central, and you think, did a comedy writer probably wrote that, right? As opposed
maybe.
To... Maybe. That's what you start to think, right? It's so random, it makes you laugh, and... Since I've watched that clip, I've watched it three or four more times. So
and if they had the original writers change the dialogue, I'm totally okay with that.
Yeah.
It's you're right. Go ahead.
I don't see, like, I love directors, but they're not the only one that makes the film. Like, I think mm-hmm. especially when it's about censorship, the editing people, the people who edit it, especially if it's a smaller film where there was a singular editor, I'm okay with that. I think they should have a bit of control.
Yeah, and I think I would rather hear something like, you know, Yippee-ki-yay, Mr. Falcon, than just have it, like, blanked out, like having the audio blanked out for, like, 2 seconds. And, you know, maybe you're right. Maybe they should, you know, and certainly there was an announcement that Sony was taking, like, the Apatow and Sandler releases, because those were the, you know, they were the ones particularly upset. About going back and getting directors and producers permission before doing it. So maybe that's part of it. It's like going to them and like saying, what are hilarious ways you can swear but not swear? Mm-hmm. Sort of make it into creative exercise. Right. And then, you know, maybe that way.
It could be a marketing ploy in itself, right?
Absolutely.
Like you look at those DVD covers that say, you know, unrated, uncut, you know.
Yeah, it's almost the opposite way.
Like, yeah, it could be clean as F. K, you know, like right there on the cover. You know?
Yeah. Okay, well, I think we've struck on something there, and perhaps people will steal our ideas.
Yeah, maybe.
You never know. We're gonna segue into something a tad more serious, which is personalities, celebrities, their private lives when sort of inflict on their public works. And we're particularly thinking about this in the case of Bill Cosby, who we're recording this in advance of when it airs Wednesday morning. But on Saturday, he was found, well, it was a hung. He wasn't found anything. It was a hung jury. So it was a mistrial. And the prosecutors are going back for more. Although Bill Cosby's lawyer was talking about being vindicated, but people are still pointing out. I lost my place, but that's okay. The typical reaction seems to be, it's like, yeah, he may never like go to jail or suffer in that regard, but at the same time, no one's going to be able to watch
the Cosby,
Cosby Show reruns again. Like no, they're probably
totally
never going to be on TV
it.
Again. Yeah.
Yeah.
Nobody looks back at it in a positive way.
Yeah.
At the Cinema One, they sold them for like a loony per season.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Just clearing them out.
Yeah. I feel bad for every other actor that was on it.
Yeah. Well, that's my thing. It's like there are like people who probably depend on those residuals, like Malcolm Jamal Warner and Tempest Bloodstone probably look forward to getting their Cosby Show check every month. But
yeah.
But, you know, never again. Yeah. And there was a professor, I think she was a law professor at Syracuse University, who said that her students had never seen an episode of The Cosby Show, but they all know who Bill Cosby is. So it's almost, right. You know, not the branding you want.
So it taints it before the fact.
Yeah.
I know when I was younger, I watched The Cosby Show when I was a kid. I'm of that age, so I saw it growing up. And I thought, oh, this is a really funny sitcom. And I remember when I was at university, people who hadn't seen it before, and they're like, and it was on, and they're like, we don't want to watch that. It's probably really corny. Mm-hmm. And then they watched it, and they were like, okay, this is a really funny show, you know, and it really struck home, struck a chord with that family setting, right? And I think that's what's hard to really separate is the fact that the show is so family-oriented too, right?
That's
so,
the messed up part.
So how can you watch a family-oriented show
And it's also the cultural factor because it was like a professional middle-class black family, which, you know, was the first of its kind, you know, going back to when they started having, you know, sort of black family sitcoms. And it was like Good Times and Amos and Andy and, it was sort of... In so much as I think a lot of, you know, African Americans were probably glad to have representation on TV, it was probably not the best representation because looking back, it plays into a lot of stereotypes. But The Cosby Show broke a lot of those stereotypes and arguably still breaks those stereotypes.
I didn't grow up with Cosby. I grew up with Fat Albert, which she was also in. In some ways, that's even worse because it's made for just kids.
Yeah.
So it totally ruined that show for me too. And it ruined the remake, which... I loved. I thought it was fantastic. And because I loved it so much, I wanted to go back. I wanted to watch the Bill Cosby Show, but I just can't do that now.
And you know what really ticked me off was he was coming out of court one day last week, and he did the hey, hey, hey. Yeah, and I was just like, do you have to ruin it anymore? It's like, you can kind of ignore the Bill Cosby in the Fat Albert cartoons, because I watched the Fat Albert cartoons too, and he would kind of introduce that the stories at the beginning and at the end. He did like a little bookends at the...
You should make a version where they edit that out, just the first part where he says something.
Yeah.
Just show the Fat Albert cartoon part.
Mm-hmm. Right. But... He was still fairly associated, even though there's he's also a character. He's one of the Junkyard Gang because it was sort of based on his childhood. But still, I mean, now it's, you can't watch that without the image of Bill Cosby coming out of court going hey, 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 which sucks.
Yeah, it's ridiculous. and it's tough. And you know, some of those other directors and actors you had mentioned. Maybe because they do more adult stuff, you don't necessarily think about it as much. Although it's hard to say, where do you draw the line and start like boycotting watching something? Because there's so much quality stuff that's been made over the years. Mm-hmm. And if you look in the people's lives who made it, often there's a lot of skeletons in the closet, right?
Well, so. Michael Jackson, for example.
Yeah.
It's hard. Yeah. I mean, since he died, it's hard to find someone who will... go after some of the charges against him. And I'm one of these people, like, I want to believe in innocent until proven guilty.
Me too.
Mm-hmm. And so you should be able to theoretically enjoy Michael Jackson's music, Cosby Show, without this sort of, you know, dark cloud over it. Mm-hmm. But, you know, when you have 30-some-odd women come out and accuse you, it's sort of hard to say that it's a massive conspiracy, as, you know, maybe some people would observe. I do want to address, because another person like this is Johnny Depp. Who, you know, it's not like, it's not explicitly like Bill Cosby or people or like legions of women are accusing him of a crime. Mm-hmm. But, you know, there was last year two charges of, you know, allegations of domestic abuse against his wife. This year it's his manager's taking him to a court because apparently he spends like a drunken sailor. This is almost... I don't want to say a world apart from Cosby, but at the same time, you know, we're sort of seeing this happen in real time where people are wondering if this is having an effect on his bottom line, because you see Pirates of the Caribbean once like, you know, catnip for families and fans, you know, not has been as well received as previous volumes. You had the not the Cat in the Hat, although we kind of look like the Cat in the Hat, but the Alice in Wonderland movie, the sequel last year, also tanked after the first one made $1 billion.
The Lone Ranger. Yeah.
Lone Ranger.
I don't even want to remember that film.
I wonder if people are maybe just getting tired with the same types of
the
films.
Because
he does like the Tim Burton films. He does the, you know, he's doing a lot of almost like retreads of the same stuff, like Pirates of the Caribbean. What number is this now? Is it
five?
I do, and that's another part of it as well, because he is, of course, that goes back to the allegations of his spendthriftiness, that he has to do these big movies so he can get the big paycheck, so he can keep buying, you know, cotton balls or whatever he's doing. I'll say one thing in defense of Lone Ranger. The final action scene, that like 15 minutes, is awesome.
It's pretty great.
But you have to slog through 2.5 hours of all the other stuff and the myth building and the army hammer and all that to get there. But that action sequence is awesome.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But in comparison to the original, just not
no,
great.
No, no. Yeah, no. It's just if they had trimmed an hour off that and then ended with that, I think we would think better of it.
Yeah, 50 minutes short would have been great.
I do want to, before we move on, I want to address Roman Polanski, too, because I think this is almost another nebulous area because it's been 40 years.
Right.
And he would have gotten out of jail by now.
Yeah.
It's. I mean, I'm always of two minds of this because, on the other hand, yeah, he's basically a fugitive. If he had stayed, he would have gone to jail, would have gotten out of jail by now. If he'd been a model prisoner, he would have gotten out probably 35 years ago. Because, well, there was a certain amount of betrayal as well. Because he reached a plea bargain. The judge threw out the plea bargain and says, oh, no, he's going to do the full sentence. And, you know, when there's an argument made that you're not getting justice, depending on your point of view, perhaps there's, there's not much to blame him. But the part of this I found interesting was that the girl he assaulted, and she was a girl, she was 13 years old, her name was Samantha Genier, has gone to court. For lenient, for the courts to basically say, okay, he can come back to the United States now and remove this. She said she in recent years she's forgiven him, but this is the first time she's gone to court to say so and to ask for leniency, which I find interesting. And perhaps she was the victim, and perhaps if she's had time to reconcile, I don't know.
Yeah, it's tough to really say from like a legal standpoint on this, but it has been 40 years, and he. But he fled, right, at that point.
I mean, that's what always sticks me, is he ran instead of...
She wants to move on. She just wants to get it out of her mind and just live a happy life, you know? Because she knows that he's never going to get caught. Mm-hmm. He never is, so she just wants to end it. And I understand that, and I respect that.
Yeah. So, yeah, we'll see what happens. I mean, it's... it keeps coming up because I think he has been arrested by Poland once, he's been arrested by Switzerland once, and so it keeps kind of circling that we're going to reach a crescendo on this. But he is 80 years old too.
Is he that old?
Yeah. Oh, wow. So he's. Yeah. I mean.
And he won an Oscar, and he couldn't come to the ceremony back in 2002.
Right? That was something that always got me. He got a standing O when they gave him the Oscar, but like a few years before that. Ilya Kazan got the honorary lifetime Oscar. And of course, Ilya Kazan, director of On the Waterfront, Streetcar Named Desire, names during the Blacklist.
Right.
And a lot of people sat there and silently when they gave him the Oscar. And it's
really?
Like,
yeah.
And it's, yeah, it's.
That's fair.
Yeah, I mean, I know a lot of people on the right kind of harp on the moral values of Hollywood, but I mean, in that instance, you have a guy who was scared for his career and did something. Morally ambiguous, and the other guy, and then on the other hand, you have the guy who assaulted a child and then ran from the country for 40 years. So it's
Was this nomination for The Pianist?
Yes,
he won for The Pianist. That's right.
I watched that in Warsaw while we were going through it, and it was I really liked it. I think it's easier to sort of block it when it's the director because you never see them in the film,
right? Unlike Rush Hour 3, where he makes a cameo.
Does he?
One of the many problems with Rush Hour 3. Speaking of problematic films, we're going to get Peter to talk about this because he actually went hardcore research-wise, watched Batman and Robin for the first time ever prepare for this.
Oh, wow.
I thought it was the first time ever.
Oh, it was?
It came out in 1997, so I was only 3 years old.
He had totally repressed it.
The second I saw Arnold Schwarzenegger's face and his costume, all of a sudden I remembered just seeing his face in theaters. I'm very glad I blocked it out. It was awful.
Yeah.
It was awful. The shots were, so many of them were tilted and weird looking. I feel like Joel Schumacher just made it for himself because everything in it I feel like he probably liked.
Well, that's what's interesting
the
because
nipples and things, he's Anna.
Because he did this interview with Vice, and he said, "I want to apologize to every fan that was disappointed," and he takes a lot of responsibility. And so is George Clooney. George Clooney will apologize. If you see George Clooney on the street and walk up to him and you go, "Apologize for Batman and Robin," he'll do it.
Good.
Good.
I thought he was decent in it, but
I mean, I don't. I don't give George Clooney a lot of crap because that was in the middle of like his like sudden resurgence after ER, and so like everyone was throwing him movie roles, and this was after like 20 years of him being a hungry actor. So if, like some people start throwing you work, of course you're going to take all the work you can possibly take. But yeah, I mean, it's not his fault. It's not Schwarzenegger's fault. I'm not even 100% sure it's Schumacher's fault.
Did Schumacher apologize for the number 23 or 8mm? Or, like, you look at his filmography and it's like...
Yeah, number 23 to me is much more offensive than Batman and Robin.
I didn't hate it. The number 23 came out when I was young, though, and I loved Jim Carrey.
Yeah.
So I just focused on Jim Carrey, and I didn't hate it as much as this.
Okay. It's one
like
of these...
23, though, percent on Rotten Tomatoes. It's not great.
Does it?
Yeah, it's got... Oh, it's low.
Well, no, number 23 has 23%, 23.
Maybe.
Coincidence.
It's below 30.
It's a conspiracy.
I do wonder if maybe someone at Rotten Tomatoes tinkered with that just to get the... Yeah. But it is funny to hear... him apologize now, because I remember this at the time. They were talking, before it came out, they were talking about making Batman 5. And it was going to be called Batman Triumphant. And they were talking to, like, Jeff Goldblum to play the Scarecrow. And I remember for
that
some...
That would have been cool.
That would have been cool. and then they were talking to, like, Gillian Anderson about playing Harley Quinn. And then they were going to have Jack Nicholson in a Joker cameo because it's going to be, like, a fear gas hallucination. And apparently, like... I know all this because I've collected this knowledge. So clearly there was some long-term planning in effect here. So when he's like apologizing and talking about how he's like painted into corners and all this, it's hard to think that he knew sort of how bad it was or what he was doing. Yeah. So from that perspective, when you're talking about him pleasing himself with all these things. I do remember Schumacher on Oprah when he was talking about casting George Clooney. He said, like, I saw him on the cover of People magazine and I drew a cowl over him and he looked good. So, yeah. I mean, that's kind of like the most thought, it seems, that went into it. It's like, what looks good?
Yeah, it also felt like, were they planning on making a third one?
After Batman
that's
Triumph.
Probably part of the reason it was bad, because a lot of it was a buildup towards that, like, Batgirl, right?
Yeah, possibly.
And the time when Joel Schumacher took over the Batman franchise, there was a lot of criticism that it was getting too dark. It was too violent, dark. Mm-hmm. So they probably brought him in, and he's for more of like a campiness to it.
Right.
And with Batman and Robin, what I saw is, okay, it's real conflict here. Is this supposed to be campy or is this supposed to be dark? They're wearing the dark outfits and everything, but yet it's unrealistic what's happening with Mr. Freeze here and Poison Ivy. It just doesn't make any
Uma
sense
Thurman
at all.
Was... Yeah, I love Uma Thurman, but in that film, she was she was awful.
Well, it's a weird team up because it's like, well, what are the two next like most popular villains? Like Mr. Freeze, and I mean, they kind of did that all along with like Penguin and Catwoman, and then Two-Face and Riddler, and you know they don't kind of go together. But because they're you're going through the list and saying, who's the most popular villain? The Joker. Who's second most? Okay, we got Catwoman and Penguin. Who's the third most? And then you're kind of going down a list, and that seems what they were doing too, is just going checkbox. And it's the same thing with on the hero side, like, you know, third one, we got Robin, fourth one, we're at back, or are they going to add in the fifth one, like Ace the Bat Hound? I don't know.
Yeah.
it's curious. We did get an explanation for nipples on the bat suit, and apparently it was inspired by Greek statues, like of the gods.
Oh, okay.
So, apparently, like, they were able to... The technology for molding rubber had gotten so good they can do nipples.
Okay,
so.
I sort of respect that then, I guess.
But a fun fact is...
It made it better. Yeah. That's interesting.
Yeah. Batgirls did not have nipples.
Oh,
so
that's true. So
Batman and Robins have nipples,
yeah.
But Batgirl's outfit did not have nipples for whatever reason.
It's an odd bit of restraint on Joel Schumacher's part.
It was weird seeing Bane the way he was, too, in comparison to the Nolan films. I found that very strange.
Well, also in just comparison to the comic book, too. I mean, and I understand why they shoehorned Bane in there, because it was like right after Nightfall in the comic books, Bane's big storyline. But, yeah, that character was awful. It was, the way he was presented. I think I read one review, looking up reviews. It was an onslaught of spoofy humor, special effects, and meaningless comic book mayhem, which about sums it up. But, you know, to go back to your point, Tim, yeah, there is number 23. But, I mean, since then, Joel Schumacher has done things like Tigerland, which basically made, what's his name?
Colin Farrell.
Yes, yeah. That made Colin Farrell's career. And you have, like, Phone Booth. You have Veronica Guerin. He's done some good things, too.
Mm-hmm. He's a very interesting director because he's done some really good quality work. And then some other, it's...
Yeah. Like St. Elmo's Fire was fantastic.
Yeah.
Although, interestingly, was not given the best reviews. When
I know. Yeah. But looking back at it, most critics like it now, I think, looking back at it.
Sure. I mean, most critics who, like, grew up with it and worked like teenagers, like, look how awesome it is to be a young adult. And like a cool. But the flip side of it is, too, I've been doing a lot of research into this. I'm not sure it's the worst comic book movie ever. I think, you know, I recently watched The Spirit. I read two, Jonah Hex. I think these are like, you know, especially when you look at who Jonah Hex had in the cast, where it had Josh Brolin, John Malkovich, Michael Fassbender.
Wow.
And it was bad?
Yes.
That's wild.
It was 80 minutes of bad.
Wow.
I don't remember this one, but I'm glad.
I don't remember either.
Well, is this another repress all moment?
No, no, no. Do you know what this one's based on? Like,
Jonah
who wrote
Hex?
It, the original?
Jonah Hex, you mean?
Oh, Jonah Hex? Okay.
Yeah. I don't know. I can't remember who directed it. Probably for the best for that man's career. But but I mean, yeah, I mean, but it's I watched the documentary on the DVD and the executive producer, Michael Uslan. He, you know, of course, he's defending. And he's like, you know what? You kind of look back and it's kind of an homage to the 60s Batman and, you know, kind of making it campy and fun and zip pow bang. And it's like, I can sort of see that. But on the other hand, I really can't see it.
and you let down a lot of fans when you do something like that because I actually do like the original Batman movie from 1966 with Adam West.
Mm-hmm.
It is so campy, and it's just based on the TV series. It's like when they're in slow motion, they're just going slower. They don't actually use slow motion, and it's fun. But there was a build up before Batman and Robin for all these films to take the Dark Knight seriously, right? And then all of a sudden he's got nipples and and Mr. Freeze is doing crazy stuff.
Nonstop puns and
pun
stuff.
After pun.
Yeah.
I remember working in Zeller's after this came out, and like years later there were still Batman and Robin toys lying around.
Did anyone buy them?
When they got cheap enough. You know, when the Mr. Freeze mobile was like $5 instead of $29.99, or, you know, I think we also had all the, like, the ice skating goons figures.
Oh, yeah.
So it's interesting that it's looking backwards and hearing them talk, well, it was kind of about the toys. And mm-hmm. I think I read that quote from Chris O'Donnell. You said it felt like we were making a big toy commercial. But in the end, like not even you couldn't even move the toys, so it was almost self defeating in that regard.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's all the air we're going to let into Batman and Robin for another 20 years. We're going to take a break. The piece of music this week is a little ditty called "Matter of Time" by The Wooden Sky, and that is from their 2017 album "Swimming in Strange Waters." It is now on the CFRU charts, and. We're going to play a little sample for you right now, because you're listening to End Credits here on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus, and Community Radio.
We'll be right back. told you you could paint fairies on the wall, huh?
They're not fairies. They're birds.
Well, who told you you could do that, huh?
Well, you did.
What?
You said, make the place look all right. I think it looks all right.
No painting in this corner, huh? No want paint on my boots, no paint on my gear. Rest is fine. Mm. Birds or fairies, no mind.
I'm not doing that.
And that was a clip from Maudie, and that's a new film by Irish director, and I'm going to probably butcher her first name, but it's Aisling Walsh, and it's about the renowned Nova Scotia artist Maude Lewis. It stars Sally Hawkins and Ethan Hawke, and I don't know about you guys, but I think I'm trying to remember if I ever heard about Maude Lewis. I think I've heard of her in passing, but were you guys aware of her before seeing
Not
this?
At all.
Not at all?
Not at all.
Not really, probably similar to you. When I saw pictures of her, I'm like, I think I saw something, or right. Maybe I saw a clip from that old CBC show.
Yeah.
But not really, no.
Well, it's an interesting movie. I found it interesting that it took an Irish director to sort of bring it to the screen, and it stars, well, Sally Hawkins is British, but Ethan Hawke is American. And but having said that, it's great to see a Canadian story on the big screen. I've got fairly engrossed by it. I'm interested to know what you guys think.
Oh, I thought it was incredible. One of the best films I've seen 2017 thus far. I saw it twice at the Bookshelf, and I love Ethan Hawke. I'm an Ethan Hawke fan. I'm a Richard Linklater fan, and he's in like half those films, right? I thought Sally Hawkins was really good in Blue Jasmine, but I love Newfoundland, just visually, the Maritimes. I thought it was spectacular, and I like how there was only around 5 characters.
Yeah.
I like how in-depth it got into Maude and Everett Lewis. I really enjoyed that.
Yeah,
I just thought the shots were gorgeous.
Interestingly, it was shot in Newfoundland instead of Nova Scotia, where she...
More expensive.
Yes, that was it. Exactly. And when I started digging into Maude Lewis, and like she has like a whole section of like an art museum, and in Nova Scotia, they preserved her house. Her house is part of the permanent exhibit.
That's right. Yeah.
And you know, they're constantly trying to find more Maude Lewis art so they can archive it and display it. And then they want to shoot a movie about Maude Lewis, and Nova Scotia's like, oh, we can't give you the tax rebates you want. And so they go to Newfoundland. It's crazy. Anyway.
Yeah, it's pretty crazy, because I know if you watch that with somebody from Nova Scotia, they'd be like, this is totally Newfoundland. Like, note there, they know the difference,
right? That's right,
right. And,
yeah.
And it's too bad that tax credit's fallen through, because the production out there in Nova Scotia now is dried up.
Yeah.
So it's a lot... Less expensive to do it in Newfoundland, but it still had that. I agree with you guys. I thought it was. I had a real emotional response to it. I'm like, oh, wow, yeah. This stuck with me the day after. It was because the acting was so incredible, I thought, by Sally Hawkins and Ethan Hawke. And the fact that it's based on a true story, you don't know how much of it's actually true, but the fact that this could have happened in Nova Scotia in a small house. She's painting for 30 years, you know, in this tiny house and still creating these, you know, wondrous, happy works of art, works of folk art. I thought it was pretty, it's an incredible story. And then the acting really held it together well, I thought, too.
Yeah. What I liked about, in terms of how they did like time and place, it's like it kind of just throws you in there. You don't know like when exactly it's taking place. You can they make an educated guess because of the cars and things, but you know, they're not always like skipping with like 7 years later and 12 years later and things like that, which are things I hate about normal bio dramas. And I've only been to the East Coast once, but I can tell the difference between Newfoundland and Nova Scotia.
Exactly. Yeah.
But I mean, that kind of took me out of it a bit. But I did appreciate how it didn't have to, it didn't hold your hand. I don't think they stopped to explain what her physical maladies were about. You know, I think they mentioned it once that she had like arthritis, mm-hmm. But you know, it doesn't stop to explain that. Nobody stops to explain how why Everett is not socialized well, shall we say? Mm-hmm. The movie just says like, okay, here are these people. This is their story. They're going to find a way to, you know, communicate and be a couple and live together, and watch Sally Hawkins' character as Maude develop as an artist and develop this relationship and see this life unfold. Nobody's holding your hand, which I found tremendously refreshing.
I really like that too. The fact it wasn't all about her physical ailments.
Yeah.
You knew, okay, she has some issues here, probably with arthritis or something.
Born with it, yeah.
Yeah, but they're not announcing it.
No.
But they did, that is sort of a reason why she's shunned from her family.
Right.
And then she moves in with Everett. She finds that in the small shack is a better way for her to express herself than in her previous life in a bigger house. It was kind of interesting.
I would have wanted to know as much about her life as possible, though, because she had parents until she was 30, and we don't hear about what happened to them. We don't hear about why her aunt thinks she needs to stay in the house and stay with her. Because I know about the arthritis, but I don't know about any mental issue or anything. So I wouldn't have mind like a bit more in the past. Maybe start it like 3 years earlier.
Yeah, I think that's a point. I do wonder how much of it maybe is just like a matter of the timing, where if you weren't, you know, a perfect specimen mentally and physically, they thought you were an invalid. I mean, attitudes have certainly changed in the last 60 years and 70 years, you know, in terms of how independent we think we know people who have disabilities are. Mm-hmm. So I do wonder if the message there is just like they were mollycoddling her, which is why she like is so awful, boldly, you know, sees this ad. And that's a great scene when they introduce Everett. Cause they don't really introduce Everett. She's at the shop, and then you see in the background, out of focus, Everett comes in to tell the storekeeper that he wants to place this ad on the post board, looking for a housemaid. And then she goes in, takes it down, and I think that's kind of implicit that she sort of feels more independent than. The people in her life want to give her credit for.
Or think that she is, yeah.
Yeah.
I wouldn't have minded seeing a bit more of his past, too. Like, the orphanage. There's so many stories, and he seems like the kind of guy there'd be so many funny things happening in the orphanage or interesting, and probably a lot of fights. He was probably in a lot of fights.
Probably. Yeah. I do find it that one of the few characters who are introduced is one of his fellow fishermen, Jack, who just kind of treats him like one of the guys and kind of ignores the socialization issues and just kind of like, you know, he gently ribs him about, you know.
I liked his character a lot.
Yeah.
Yeah, he was sort of a check on him a little bit, on his brutality, too.
Like,
you got to be nice now. You're married now. You have to be nice.
Mm-hmm. And he's right.
Yeah.
The scene where he, and this is shortly after she moves in as a housemate, where he strikes her. What was the react? Because the audience was kind of chuckling along at, you know, oh, it's cozy in there. And then he strikes her, and then everyone's like, oh.
Everyone went silent. Yeah. Laughing. Yeah. And then the second that happened, silence.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's kind of, that's another thing that's kind of never addressed. Again, you know, we kind of see these things in movies where the romantic lead has kind of a brutality streak, and it happens just the once, but of course it's there in the back of your head the whole time. And when, you know, when he's saying things like later on, you know, when he's talking about how she thinks he's not good enough for her anymore because she's getting all this recognition for her paintings. And you know, recognizing that no relationship is perfect, it is something that kind of sits with you through the movie, and it's kind of never addressed again.
And it's something like after the movie, you're so interested, or I was. I went and Googled and read more about it, and it seems like there's a lot of ambiguity regarding their life together, and it may have been a lot more brutal than what's depicted.
Mm-hmm.
But when you make a movie like that, you want there to be hope. You want there to be, you know, you don't want it to be one note, just dark. And it seems like that Everett character in the movie, he's kind of seen as a guy who can't really take care of himself. But what I read in real life is he was quite the miser, quite the shyster. Like he's stowed away all the money from the paintings.
Right.
It was good they didn't get into this because he actually died in 79, like 9 years later, because there was an attempted robbery at his house because somebody was thinking, oh, he's probably hiding money in the backyard or something.
Right.
And there's an altercation and he was killed. So,
yeah, that isn't addressed too much. They did show a clip from, I guess it was from the CBC story at the end of the film,
right,
where he's like kind of smiling and things. So I almost wonder if maybe he wasn't as, non-social as Ethan Hawke sort of portrayed him. Mm-hmm. Because in those scenes where they're filming the CBC documentary, he's kind of like sitting in the corner, like humphing. But in the actual shots, he's like wandering around the house and smiling. And right. I don't know. It is interesting. The story there, because it feels like, because we don't know a lot about Everett's life, that maybe they could have maybe they took some liberties, either making him a little more into what Ethan Hawke portrays instead of maybe how he actually was.
Well, based on what we're talking about, I'm glad. Yeah, exactly. I'm just gonna imagine that Everett Lewis was like that,
right,
was like how Ethan Hawke portrayed him, because they just seem so perfect together, and I just loved how most of the shots were just them together. The first. Obviously, the hit that was awful, but that was too realistic from back then. That happened quite a bit, and it wasn't viewed as being as bad, which isn't a good thing. But I liked them being together.
Exactly, it's like a great love story, and the fact like how are these two people together? like they have so many. Unique traits. I'll put it that way, right? Yeah. And how did they find each other? And it just. And in that context, it's actually a great love story when you think about it. Yeah,
I do love the scenes where they're haggling together, and there's a scene where she's been selling the postcards of her paintings, and her sort of main benefactor, I can't remember the woman's name, but she's played by Carrie Machette, comes to her and says, like, can you paint something bigger? And so Everett immediately goes, $5. and so she keeps talking to Maude, and is like, and she wants her to send the painting to her in New York. She's like, well, does that include postage?
She was smart.
Yeah, it was pretty clever. And the scene later on where, and this happened in real life, where Nixon wrote to her and wanted some paintings. And she says, I got a letter from President Nixon. And Everett's like, what did he want? like they're oddly familiar. It's like Nixon's the annoying neighbor down the way. I did love how they played off each other. And Ethan Hawke, this could have been such a showy role, but he does it in such a non-showy way. He really invests himself in the character, which I'm not a huge Ethan Hawke fan like you, but I what I would recognize in an opportunity like this is for an actor to overreach. And he doesn't. He goes very inside.
Very in-depth into the character. Yeah, they all did.
Yeah. Although, to go back to Carrie Machette, one of the things that bugged me is that it felt like she was doing, like, a Cate Blanchett impression of Katharine Hepburn. And I'm not sure what the choice was there. Like, is this how people in New York would talk in the 60s?
They're all like that.
You're from New York.
Yeah, so y'all from New York, and talking like this. And, I mean, it's fine because the focus of the movie isn't on her, but it just, whenever she appeared on screen again and started talking in this Blanchett meets Hepburn voice, I'd rather talk in your own voice. It's fine. You can say you're from, because she does say I live in New York part of the year, and so that's fine. I don't need to you to vocalize it in that way.
That's all I need to know about her.
Yeah. Yeah, and you're right, a very small cast, like Gabrielle Rose, who's one of these actresses you'll like recognize because she's like in every show that's shot in Vancouver and in tons of Canadian movies.
Is she Canadian?
Yeah.
Oh, cool.
So she was good. The guy who played the brother, Zachary Bennett, is also Canadian. He's from London, actually. I looked that up on IMDb. And that's another small role, but he does so much in like maybe 2-3 minutes of scenes. You know, he's just so oily whenever he appears, and you're just like, oh, look who's back, Charles.
I hated him so much.
Yeah, man. I know.
I got tense every time he came on the screen. I just wanted to get up there and just punch him or something.
Yeah, because he always wanted something, right?
Yeah.
That's all, you know, whatever was in his best interest, financially, basically.
Right. Mm-hmm. And it's implied that he sold the family home because, you know, out for Maude, who was, you know, living there, that to pay off debts. One of the things I noticed about him is that he always uses sister. He doesn't, he pointedly says, hello, sister, goodbye, sister, instead of, like, using her name. I think he did use her name a couple of times, but what stuck out to me more was, like, the sister, and it goes to show you. It's a very simple verbal cue of just, like, how much he sort of views her as a as a burden, or in when she becomes famous as a painter, an opportunity. Exactly. And then when she shuts him down, it's back to, okay, sister, bye, sister. Mm-hmm. It's very subtle, but it just shows you what he thought of her.
He didn't even view her as like a person, just something he could use, right?
Yeah. What I find about it is it shows you what you can do with a small story like this. It's mostly one setting. It's mostly inside the house, two actors going at it. And I think it's very strong on that account that it's you know what they call a clinic in terms of showing you what actors can do.
Mm-hmm. And I didn't get bored once.
No, even though there's no high drama. You know, maybe the one part when her and Everett have a fight, but
even that was minor drama.
Yeah, but I mean it's just watching a life unfold. And again, it goes back to, you know, how there's no measurement, there's no time. You know, you're just kind of sort of watching it roll on, and it's almost kind of like I don't want to say it's a dream, kind of as watching it unfold. But there is almost a dreamlike quality to it. It very much knows this is not like a big life. This is not someone who went out and achieved tremendous things. They were a painter and they sat in their chair and painted all their lives. But at the same time, it does give you a very good sense of how big someone's life can be just doing the smallest things.
Mm-hmm. Right. And the acting clinics, when you forget that they're actors, right?
Yeah.
They're listening to each other. They're communicating well. And you can see, okay, you think you're watching Maude Lewis and Everett Lewis, and that's perfect.
That they were just playing themselves.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, that's what I thought until the end where they showed the real video of those two.
Right.
Yeah.
And again, I thought it was just a documentary.
Yeah, it's... Well, I didn't quite go that far, but it's... what it reminds me, too, is that it's kind of sad how little we know about ourselves. Mm-hmm. You know, I think a contemporary of Maude Lewis would probably be somebody like Jackson Pollock or what's his face? The soup cans. Andy Warhol. Mm-hmm. I can't believe I forgot Andy Warhol, but there you go. But, you know, you could probably name five things, you know, about those artists off the top of your head, whereas yeah. Maude Lewis has, you know, lived in relative obscurity in her own country. And I think that's one of the things I'm really grateful to a movie like this for is you know, showing the power of Canadian lives and how we've had a lot of interesting people in this country outside of, you know, politicians and war heroes and that kind of thing. You know, here's a simple woman living a simple life, and there's the scene at the end or near the end where her aunt says to her, it's like, well, you know what, you've lived in poverty almost your whole life and living out in the middle of nowhere with this other man and, you know, just painting in your little house, but you're probably the happiest of all of us.
That was my favorite line.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's really, that's really powerful. And I'm not sure I appreciate the working class poverty is, you know, the key to, you know, goodness angle, you know, yeah. That this is the beautiful life is the one where you live in a poor hovel all your life. Yeah. I'm not sure I see the virtue in that, but there is something right about it as well. They had a very simple life and lived it simply. And
it's what they're into.
Yeah.
Yeah. And you make a good point about Canadian stories because you started this segment by asking, have we heard of Maude Lewis? And none of us really had. We vaguely knew about her, and so it took an Irish-Canadian co-production shot in Newfoundland really to bring that to the fore. So there's probably many more opportunities to showcase Canadian lives, big and small.
Oh yeah.
And I know this was this was one of the films of note that came out of TIFF last year. And it's been getting a lot of attention on the art house circuit in the States as well. And I think that's a great reminder there, because I'm thinking back to last year's TIFF, and what opened last year's TIFF was The Magnificent Seven, big mm-hmm. lavish Hollywood remake of a Hollywood remake of a Kurosawa film. And, you know, meanwhile, there's this thing called Maud or Maudie mm-hmm. that is a Canadian story, powerfully told, wonderfully acted. And I don't know if it had like a gala screening or if it was sort of like just shown quietly at the Scotiabank or something. Yeah. But it's something to think about, you know. Maybe in the future, TIFF, less Magnificent Sevens and more Mauds.
Films of this nature, yeah. I think Maudie might get nominated for an Oscar. It actually says that on the movie poster for it.
Oh, yeah.
So I hope Sally Hawkins wins that, because then people will also remember Maudie for longer, a lot longer, and she deserves that.
Even just a nomination, because it's...
Yeah.
The scene at the beginning where it shows her older and like struggling with her arthritis and still painting, I found that incredibly, just that first initial scene incredibly moving, because I often think about that myself as someone who uses my hands to type and write. You know, what happens when this goes, mm-hmm. And how do you do the thing you do then? And so it's just like a 2-minute scene of her like basically like holding her hand, moving the brush up and down. And it's just like, oh, this is going to be
deep.
Yeah, this is going to be there will likely be tears in the end. And this is one of those movies, speaking of audience reaction, where, you know, at the end, everyone kind of sits there as the credits roll and sort of just like, oh, well, that happened.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's all sinking in at the end there, and you just sit. And you can't say that about a lot of movies, because usually mm-hmm. when the credits start rolling, you're like, okay, I'm going to stand up, grab my coat,
put my hat on.
You know? But that one, I know, like, most people in the theater were just sitting for the credits. So.
Yeah.
And what you're saying about TIFF, you know, makes sense too, because I saw a few things at TIFF last year, didn't even know about Maudie, right?
Yeah,
and it's like, I'm looking on Rotten Tomatoes, oh, this is opening soon. Okay, this would be a good one to look at here. And, well, it's opening in the States, but it's been out for a couple months here already,
yeah.
And mm-hmm. it was at TIFF, but you don't, you know, it takes that Oscar nomination or something for us
to hear more about it.
In Canada, even to really hear more about it, right? So
yeah, because this is we all saw it at the Bookshop, but this is a return engagement for it. Like it was so popular, they brought it back. Mm-hmm. So it's been out in Canada for at least 2 months, mm-hmm. and it's sort of floating under the surface. Which, I mean, and that's sad. And you could say that about so many different movies, but I just think, you know, we're coming up on Canada 150 in a right. week and a half, couple of weeks, and here we are like saying, we're surprised to have this Canadian story in a Canadian movie about a Canadian person, and it's so terrific, and it shouldn't be that surprising when we get a really good Canadian story, and it's engrossing, and it's life-affirming and powerful in its own way, and it's especially on top of this person who we think, I think I've heard of them, mm-hmm. and yeah.
It was a good year to pick for this film, for sure.
Yeah. Yeah, it's. I'm glad we did this one. And I think by the time this airs, it won't be playing on the bookshelf anymore, but who knows, I'm going to bring it back for a third month. And, it'll definitely be on VOD and mm-hmm. Maybe even Netflix, you know, into the near future. So I think we all highly suggest that people go out there and check out Maudie when it comes out.
We do, definitely.
And then rewatch it as much as you can.
Solid advice. So that's going to bring us to the end of end credits this week, and we hope you liked it. And if you do like it, you can hear it again on endcreditsradioshow.com. That is our website. You can also visit End Credits Radio Show on Facebook and End Credits Radio on Twitter, and that's our social media feeds. And please like us and follow us and do all that stuff. Peter, if people want to seek you out online, how can they do that?
Only Twitter, Mr. Towel Rack, Twitter. Mr. Towel Rack. And that's it.
I'm almost afraid to ask the origin of that. Tim, where can people find you?
On Vimeo, Flash in the Deadpan. Or if you just want to Google Flash in the Deadpan, you can find some films I've worked on and check them out. Thanks.
And thank you guys for taking part this week. We look forward to having you back. I write about movies and TV shows and other nerdy stuff every day at nerdbastards.com, and I will be back here on CFRU Thursday at 5 p.m. for news and politics on Open Source's Guelph, and that is with my partner there, Scotty Hertz, so please tune in. And stay tuned for more great programming here on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus and Community Radio, and we will be back here next Wednesday morning for more end credits, and we'll see you guys then.